Hey folks, welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte. I'm a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. So the idea behind the podcast is simple. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, you can check out my website at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. So let's get going on this journey of the heart.
We're continuing our series on eating disorders today. My guest is Constance Rhodes. Constance is a founder and CEO of Finding Balance Incorporated, a faith-based health and wellness organization with an emphasis on eating and body image issues. She's the author of Life Inside the Thin Cage and The Art of Being. She also hosts a weekly podcast at TruthSisterhood.com. You can visit her website at FindingBalance.com. where you can access all kinds of help and support. Constance, thanks for joining us today on Heartline.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Well, first of all, I love Life Inside the Thin Cage. I just gave it to one of my teens this week, so I just continue to use it as a resource. It's just a great book.
Thank you.
And we've been sort of all over the map with disordered eating, from restricting to purging to chronic dieting. You wrote in Life Inside the Thin Cage about your mom's struggle with food and body image issues. How did that impact you as a child and adolescent? What messages did that send for you?
Well, you know, the biggest thing was, and you know, when you're that young, you're not really thinking about how you're being impacted. So a couple of the things that I talk about now when I speak is, first of all, there was a bit of chaos in the home. Bulimia in particular, which is what she wrestled with, as you know, is kind of a more chaotic type of eating disorder. You know, it's just the person generally feels pretty out of control. There's a lot of sporadic things happening. And so I think that I felt that happening in the home, and that was had an effect on me, even though I didn't realize what it was. She had gone to try and get treatment for that, but it didn't really help a whole lot. So there was the periods of time that she was gone when I was very lonely, but again, not realizing it. But I was lonely and wanting her to be there, and then when she was there, she was so consumed with her addiction that she wasn't really present with us. And so what I've learned now as a grown-up is that the net result of all of that was me walking through life feeling very lonely and trying to come up with ways to either medicate that loneliness or to try and be somebody that somebody wouldn't leave and, you know, would give more attention to. And so that theme has played throughout my life. So I've never realized it until just recently, and I'm 39. So it took a long time for me to even understand the impact of all of that, you know, that was happening in the home.
Sure. Was your mother ever critical of your weight or your body image? Did she talk a lot about you, or was it more critical of herself?
Well, she was more concerned with her own body. I do remember, I think I wrote about it in Life Inside the Thin Cage, that she did have a picture on the refrigerator of, you know, a Target sort of body that she wished she could have. It wasn't her, it was someone else. But she didn't really ever say things about my weight, and my weight was not an issue. I've got a pretty good metabolism. Unless I'm doing crazy things with food, my body isn't something to worry about. Now, later in life, when I started the work that I'm doing now, she did tell me that when I was about 3, maybe even getting into my 4-year-old year, that she was concerned because I was a very chunky little girl, and she had anxiety within herself, but I don't recall her ever communicating that to me.
Mm. Okay. For quite a while, you said, I don't have an eating disorder, I just watch what I eat. And we know that denial is a strong force for those folks who struggle with eating disorders. How did you break through that wall and finally admit you had a problem?
Well, as I document a lot of that in the Life Inside the Sin Cage book, but basically, you know, if somebody makes one comment to you, you can just toss it aside. And somebody makes another one, and you kind of go, oh, that's a little weird, but I'll toss it aside. And then by the time you get, like, the third or the fourth comment, you're either a fool or you go, huh, maybe there's something to this. And so what I talked about in the book was just a story when my father, after several little comments over previous months from other people, I was home for Christmas, and my father took me out, and he just said, hey, you know, I'm really concerned about you, and he starts sharing some of his concerns with me. And when you added that to all the little various little comments and different things that had come up in my life kind of during that same season, I realized, you know, there's enough being said that I need to, I'm either a fool, I can choose to be foolish and ignore this, or I can, you know, admit that maybe there's something going on. And so that is what I did do. I went to the doctor, and she checked me out, and I told her, you know, kind of everything I did, and I thought I was totally fine. And then when I walked out of her office, she had written a diagnosis of anorexia, which I knew wasn't right because every good disordered eater knows the criteria, and I knew the ones that I'd missed. But again, it was like, okay, so here's this stacking up of comments over the last months, and then my father's big conversation, and now there's a doctor writing this diagnosis on a piece of paper, and even though I know that technically I haven't met all the criteria for that, you know, what am I going to do with this information? And my choice at that time, as scary as it was to choose to accept that maybe something was going on.
So that was a turning point for you then?
It was a huge turning point. It was very scary. I remember sitting in the car. I was supposed to head back to work for a board meeting, you know, and sitting in the car, and first of all, you know, the screaming in my head was, you're a failure, you're such a fool, and everyone knows that you have this big problem, and you don't, and you can't show your face now, you know, all that awful accusing stuff that runs through your head. But I also just kind of had this sense that if I would make a choice right then, to go ahead and allow God to talk to me, you know, and lead me toward recovery from this, it was kind of either now or never. Either live this way forever and keep pretending there's nothing wrong, or go ahead and make a choice to let God come in. That was, you know, faith is a big part of who I am, and let Him somehow walk me through this. And even in my conversation with God in that moment, I was like, you know, I don't want to give this up. I believe that this is what makes my life work. But I, you know, I pray that you would help me to be willing to consider maybe thinking about giving this up. I mean, it was a really minor prayer, but it was still bigger than what I had been doing all along, in that I was basically acknowledging, wow, I have a problem, and I don't know how to deal with it, and God, I need your help.
Yeah, well, you got sick and tired of being sick and tired. You came
well, I didn't realize how sick and tired I was. I started to realize how sick and tired I was after that prayer. That was one of the things, and I wrote about this in the book, that when we begin to recognize the cost, because here's, let's put this in context. At that time, I was just a chronic dieter. I was not anorexic. I was not bulimic. I did not binge. I just carefully watched what I ate. I was thin. I had comments from women who were, you know, kind of snarky because they were jealous of my thinness. I had a job in the music business that was going very well. I was married. I wore all the right clothes. I was highly productive. So it was really easy for me to say, this is just not a problem. This is what makes all this work. Oh, my goodness, if I gain weight, then women won't be jealous of me anymore. Well, the problem was I needed women to be jealous of me because I didn't know how to be in relationship. When I began to realize how lonely I was, that was one of the costs. But I was like, wow, you know, my whole life revolves around this. And I can't even look women or other people in the eye because I'm so ashamed of who I am on the inside. Ew, like I don't want to live that way. I want to have relationship. And then I began to see how tired I was. And then I began to see how, you know, sometimes I felt really weak in the shower, you know, like I was going to pass out. As I started to add up all of these costs, really my eyes were opened, and then I was able to get angry at what I thought had been this great friend to me, you know, this great, you know, thing that was going to help me accomplish everything that I wanted.
Yeah, well, what you're saying is, and as crazy as it sounds, eating disorders meet needs for people who suffer with them. So there's always this payoff, and the payoff for you was, gee, women are looking at me, they're jealous of me, all this is happening for me, life's working for me, even if it's self-destructive. So this thing met needs for you, gave you a sense of identity, gave you a sense of control, value and worth, maybe?
All of those things. I mean, I really believed this was who I was. And so if I gained a pound, then my identity would be taken away from me, which is such a precarious way to live. Because you do gain pounds, you know, and you do live life. And so, yes, everything was based on what does everyone else think of me? And in my mind, I had built up that the most important thing was, you know, I got to be really successful and I got to be really thin. And if I fail on either one of those points on any given day, then I don't know who I am anymore, and I certainly know that I don't matter. And so the interesting thing is that here I am, I'm, oh gosh, 12 years, you know, down the road from then. And I'm still recognizing how I look to my achievement. It's not so much that I don't have an eating disorder anymore, but I look to my achievement. What can I accomplish? Still, how do I look in order to feel like I matter? So it's kind of a lifelong battle of allowing God to strip those things away from us that we turn to define us. Because, of course, really, they don't really define us. You know, we are
Absolutely.
Who God created us to be, and that's who we are. But it's sometimes...
So what happened for you? Yeah, what happened for you if you weren't thin or successful? What did you believe? If I'm not thin or if I'm not successful,
well, I think at the core is you fear that you'll be abandoned by everyone. But the odd thing is you've so isolated yourself by, you know, trying to be that you already sort of, you're lonely anyway, you know?
Yeah. And that's why the control is such an illusion, you know, because you believe all these things. You believe that you have this control. But really, just like people say, well, I'm just going to lose a few pounds and I can control that. And then, you know, what I tell my gals is that it becomes the monster that overtakes you. You're not in control of this anymore at all. It's controlling you.
It takes a really long time to understand that. In fact, when I first wrote Life Inside the Thin Kids, I was like, you know, a lot of people told me this was about control, but it really wasn't about that for me. And then later I realized, yes, it was. And no, I didn't have the control. So in one of the chapters in the book, I wrote a chapter called That Which Defines Us Controls Us, because I began to realize whatever I believe defines me, that's who I'm giving the ultimate power in my life to. And really the only thing that should define me is God, and he can be trusted with that power. But I can't give that power to my husband or my friends or, you know, my body or anything. There's nothing else that can define me.
Mm-hmm. The other thing you alluded to a few minutes ago was this whole idea of security that, you know, okay, this is what's made life work all this time for me. You know, I'm comfortable in this, even though it's, you know, maladaptive or self-destructive. There's a fear for folks oftentimes to step outside that box, you know, this is my identity now, and consider, as you said, or be willing to consider another way. So for you, what was the pivotal push for that? Just the fact that you were at the end of your rope, that you had, you know, totally experienced brokenness, that you were able to confront the fear of those things?
I don't know exactly. I just know that I did begin to recognize the cost. I did begin to recognize how lonely I was. I didn't want to live that way. And then as I began to try to just be me, you know, not this fabricated, any smart, you know, intelligent, you know, accomplished person, but just be myself, I had glimpses of people responding positively to me when I was just me. And
so
the more that I got
to
see that. Yes, yeah. The more I got to see it, the more it reinforced that, oh, I guess that's true, that people like me better when I'm just being me and not trying to, they don't care about that. That was another thing, like, we assume, those of us who, you know, focus so hard on our bodies, we assume that everyone cares. and they just don't. They're worried about their own body, or they're worried about other things. They really don't care about our bodies like we think they do.
So yeah, it's all that jumping to conclusions. Yeah, mind reading, all that stuff that we do. Personalization,
yeah.
All of those cognitive distortions that we use, absolutely. Many people who've written about eating disorders talk about this negative mind or the eating disorder voice. For those folks who struggle with those negative tapes that play over and over in their minds every time they want to eat something, oh, you're going to be fat, you're a loser, you aren't disciplined, what would you tell them? How did you succeed in quieting the eating disorder voice? And do those tapes still overplay in your mind even today?
Yes, they do. Like, I know the politically correct answer would be no, but yes, they
mm-hmm.
do. So I wrote a whole chapter in the book called The Message of the Tapes, and because they're so loud, you know, they tell us so many different things, and I've done a lot of videos on this as well where we talk about it. So I think one thing is writing down all of those messages on paper. You write them down on paper so that you can just acknowledge them, what they are. The next step is you, with someone you trust, you read them or let them read what you've written down. Which is really vulnerable to do, because you're sure they're all true. You don't want your friend to think that about you. But you do it with someone you trust. You let them read them, and you let that person reflect truth to you and say, wow, that's wacky. You know, I can't believe that's going through your head. Oh, this is not true. And you allow them, you ask God to help you receive the truth of what they're saying, okay? They lose their strength gradually as we fight against them. So if a message is, you failed and nobody likes you now, then you go and you talk to a friend and say, gosh, I really bombed at this particular thing, and I really am feeling kind of insecure right now. And you allow them to say to you, wow, well, okay, maybe it wasn't the best thing ever, but I still like you. You know, but see, all of that mm-hmm. requires relationships. So none of that will happen as we are stuck isolated in the addiction. We've got to venture out through counseling, through groups, through our other friendships and relationships, and venture out there and risk being rejected so that we can know that relationship and have that truth reflected to us when we are powerless to speak it to ourselves.
Right, and you have to be willing to feel uncomfortable sometimes, even with that.
Yeah.
And realize that being uncomfortable, you're not going to explode, you're not going to disintegrate, you'll live, you'll learn to manage in more adaptive and healthy ways.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And also, I think, yeah, and trying to help folks move things into middle ground, like what you were saying a minute ago, usually beliefs are very polarized. I have to be perfect or I'm the worst person in the world. And trying to help folks move down the continuum more to middle ground is really critical with those tapes, okay? So I might not be the most perfect person in the world, but, you know, I do a good job at something. I might not have a million relationships, but one person I know likes me. So just kind of reinforcing that is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what I'm doing a lot with people, and I want you to speak into this, is really having, it's great having folks come alongside of you and speaking truth into you. That's so necessary, and the relationship piece is so awesome that you're doing that work with folks. But I'm getting folks to, you know, write those beliefs down, like you said, and then maybe giving them a scripture to refute that belief. And I may ask them to sit with that verse. You know, just a small verse, like, the Lord is near in Philippians. Be anxious for nothing. There's a little verse, the Lord is near, tucked in there. And just mm-hmm. ponder and meditate on that verse, maybe for a week, in light mm-hmm. of whatever the belief is or what they're struggling with, and saying, Father, make this rhema to me. What do you want me to know about this? And as God begins to reveal truth to them, man, that far outweighs anything I can tell them.
Yeah.
God
well, yes,
that
but God
life.
Uses us too to reinforce that, and that's where I
absolutely.
Think sometimes the wrong message can come across, which could be all you need is God, and just get alone with God, and you'll be fine. Now, God is all we need. I'm not arguing
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And we do need time alone with Him. But for the person who's isolated, there's been that wonderful balance of, okay, I'm going to get some time alone with God, and then I'm going to get with His people. and have them reflect His truth to me, where we can talk about this scripture together, and they and I can share what's going on with me, and we can talk about how this applies. So we're always pushing for of that, you know, because I just think sometimes Christians feel like they're not supposed to struggle with this stuff. They should be able to work it out just with God. You know, privacy is their closet, but that's where
that's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, God created us for a relationship.
Yeah.
And we need to be willing to take masks off and get real, get honest with each other, and in such a way we're uplifted.
Yeah.
And that, you know, as we tell our stories, it makes other people feel more comfortable telling theirs and taking
absolutely
their masks off.
Absolutely right. And that's what people need to think about, is when somebody reveals something really personal and embarrassing to you, does it make you like them less or more? Usually, more, because then you feel better about your own stuff.
Yeah, and you feel connected to them in a way, you know, that breeds, you know, a connection, and you're willing to be more vulnerable. So that's very, very powerful. That's huge. So that was really helpful for you, is this whole relationship piece.
Yeah,
if you could... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just said it hasn't come easy. It definitely has been a very long process that I'm still growing in.
Yeah, yeah. Scary thing for folks who are used to keeping people on the periphery of their life. If you could say one thing, and I know this is probably a hard question, but if you could say one thing that helped you overcome your eating disorder, what would that be?
Oh, that is a hard question. Yeah, for me, as trite as this may sound, I really believed that God wanted more for my life. And, you know, I actually felt called to this work when I was 19 for struggling with an eating disorder. And so the vision that He kind of refreshed in my heart about, I have a purpose for you. I have something that I want to do with you. That gave me a huge amount of incentive to want to get through this. And I think we all need some kind of incentive like that, some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. That this is really hard work, but there's so much life ahead of us, that, and so much goodness. Not that life will be grand and glorious, but there's goodness ahead of us, and we really have, you know, a purpose that God has created us for, and He can't use us fully for that until, well, He can use us more fully the more well we are. And so to be able to walk through life, you know, doing stuff that is not limited to, oh my goodness, what did I eat and what size am I wearing and all of that anxiety and stress, you know, being able to see a light at the end of that tunnel, I think, has probably been one of the biggest things for me motivation-wise, and relationship has been the biggest thing as far as actually being able to walk forward in that.
That's exactly what you just talked about that I've written in my book on loss, and that is a kingdom mindset, a purpose for reinvesting your heart after the losses of life. And that is so powerful. That's what gives us, it's the scripture in Luke where He says, Simon, Simon, I've asked to sift you as wheat. And then He goes on at the end of that verse to say, and I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you turn back, strengthen your brother. So that's what you're saying. It's like when we've told our story, we need to be a conduit of hope for others. We need to be reaching back and strengthening our brothers with a kingdom purpose in mind. So how can I reinvest my life and my heart into something that's going to promote healing and hope for other people? And so that's what your ministry is about. That's what you're doing. And that's just a great thing, because that's what spurs us on.
I think so. And one of my friends who wrote the book True Faced would say God's dreams for us are way bigger than our own. And they're never just about us. They're always about other people. God's dreams for us are always about other people, loving them, serving them, pointing them to Him. And so you've seen what I've seen is, you know, everybody who has an eating disorder, not everybody, but a lot of people, oh, I need to write a book about it, and you know, because I need to. But it's, you know, what is God's dream for your life, and how might that be bigger than what you've even been thinking? And how might it be different? How might it be similar? And just being open to Him revealing to you how He wants to use your life. And sometimes you're using your life as something that's not big and grand, you know, but it's not any less important. So
maybe just walking alongside somebody else and telling your story to them so that they'll feel safe
enough.
One
person at a time, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. That's great. I just can't thank you enough for your time today. I wanted to just tell folks here at the end how they can get in touch with you Why don't you give us that information?
Yeah, if you go to Finding Balance. Yeah, go to findingbalance.com. You can email me at constance@findingbalance.com. And I do want to mention that we have a conference in June at Glen Eyrie in Colorado Springs. It's the only Christian eating disorders conference, and it's for professionals and community folks. So if you want to come out to that, just go to findingbalance.com and check that out. And you should be there, girl.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you at the AATC conference. You got to email me those details. And what about the podcast? Give us that one more time.
Yeah, so truesisterhood.com, and it's four women getting pretty real about all the kinds of stuff we're talking about. So.
Awesome. Constance, thank you so much for giving up your precious time today and speaking with us, and I know it's going to be a blessing to anybody who hears it that's struggling with this. So God bless you.
Thank you, Rita. All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
I had a
big hole in my heart,
and I was looking. I was looking everywhere. That's a wrap for our show today. Thanks so much for joining us. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.